general theme, which I introduced and took some distance last night, I called the scope of reflection. And the point I tried to make in a variety of ways was to try to give substance to our common statement that we do live in an emerging new kind of age, in a literally new world. And my effort was to get back of that general and indisputable statement, to try to discern the concrete changes, shifts, emergence, which are constitutive of that new world. And in most general terms, I tried to point out that our children live in an expanding world of reflection, that the sheer size and length of time in which actuality has been, in which the theater of the human enterprise is, that theater is enormously expanded in terms of space and enormously elongated in terms of time. Man has been here longer than my generation supposed. His history is yearly disclosed by research to be more and more complicated. And man's existence in the earth as a small part of a single system of systems within systems within systems that spin out into dreamlike magnitudes, this is the actual world of reflection in which the Christian faith must now ask after the relevance of its language. If we talk about creation, we mean more than the chrysanthemums and the bullfrogs and men and women. If we talk about redemption, we must ask, is the ultimate meaning of the redemption simply God's historical action for Homo sapiens in this place? Or what is the meaning of Paul's statement about the whole creation groans in a kind of travel of expectation, awaiting its redemption? Now, having said that, I want to take another crack at another point I made last night as a kind of preparation for the advance that I hope to make tonight. I talked last night about theology as not only a knowledge of man's reflection about God, but theology is also a constant doing, as well as a remembering, a transmitting, a refining. Theology is something that the church does, not something only that she has. Therefore, a theologian is not simply a kind of a deep freeze in which the past is preserved and at 7:45 Monday, Wednesday, and Friday thawed out briefly for the attentive listener. But theology is a kind of vocation in which the accumulations of the past and the experiences of the present are always freshly attuned to the phenomena of the emerging, changing, frenetically racing world. Now, there's nothing, in one sense, there's nothing new about that. Christian thought has never been like a dog chasing its tail, running around in a circle occupied only with the church. Christian thought from the beginning has asked, if this disclosure of God about the source, the structure, the process of things, if this be the word of God and therefore the truth, how does this truth thus disclosed relate to man, to nature, to man as history? And in that process, theology has had an enormous and changing career. Dr. Barrett this morning talked about how the early church already, in the very first generation of Christians, confronted people for whom a new kind of vocabulary, a particular way of address had to be devised. And critical analysis of the New Testament documents indicates that documents dealing with the same event are not all the same. because they were addressed to different receptors, to different audiences. And that process goes on all through the history of theology. When theology moved from the eastern section of the Mediterranean, when the community moved from the eastern section of the Mediterranean into Europe and into the empire, she confronted a language, a way of thinking, a set of public institutions, a set of private analyses of man in solitude and in community, which were different than the Semitic East. And St. Augustine, in the tremendous operation of his lifetime, fitted a Semitic-based set of images into the psychology and the sociology, and particularly the political life of the West. He also, as Christer Stendahl has tried to show in his last little book, he also maybe permanently stuck Christian theology with a kind of an introspective conscience characteristic of Western culture, which was not characteristic of Semitic or Hellenistic culture. And in a sense, that may have been the reason why St. Paul's work emerged to be almost normative for aspects of some Western communities to the less attentive regard to other strands in the New Testament witness to Christ. Now, tonight, I want to talk about, ask the ancient question, and give a kind of quick, almost obscene condensation of the biblical position on this point. Obscene, not in what I say, but the brevity with which I'm going to try to say it. When the Bible asks the question, what is man? There are no logical, anthropological, psychological, sociological definitions of man in the Bible, just as there are no definitions of God in the Bible. It's a little stunning to realize that God is never defined. In the Hebrew Scriptures, God is what God does. You remember when the question is put to a Hebrew teacher about God, he says, "He is the one who," and then follows a list of the mighty acts of God. God is that power, force, judgment, and grace back of these acts, which are transparencies to his reality. He led you out of Egypt. He led you through the great and terrible wilderness. He gave you his law and his covenant. He is the one who this and this and this. So that there is no definition of man, but there are kind of paradigms of where man stands. Let me look at several of them. In the very first chapter of the Bible, we have a kind of story there in which man is spoken of from three angles of vision as a creature with three dimensions, or, put it another way, who is constituted by three enormous forces. First of all, he is from God. God is prior. He is the creator. Man is the creature. God calls him into his existence. As Calvin used to put it, man's existence is a subsistence. He subsists under God's eternal existence. So his God relationship is the first constitutive member in his structure. And then no longer sooner has God made man. And notice, he makes him not out of angelic dust or out of sheer gas or wind, but he makes him out of the dust of the earth. This is a symbolic and powerful way of saying that man belongs to the biological order. He is part of nature. He has potentialities which transcend pure nature, but never annihilates nature. He cannot lay aside his natural beginning, his structure, his rootedness in the same ecological system which is constitutive of the natural world. God, having made man, then, and made him in such a way that is disclosed most eloquently in Augustine's famous statement, "Thou hast formed us for thyself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless till they rest in thee." That's not a psychological report. It's a theological report that man is a theological datum. He comes from theos, and he cannot so understand himself or his world as to eliminate that. But he not only made man, but do you recall, he made another. I won't use the dirty word helpmeet, but he made another sufficiently different and delightful as to secure that there should be a number of others. With that arrangement, I have no personal argument at all. But the point of the story of Eve, and in Hebrew, the word means the mother of all the living, and as Adam means man. He not only made the woman, but the important point, the most important point, is not the feminine thing, but another human being, which means, as the Germans put it, ein Mensch ist kein Mensch. A single person is no person. A solitary person has not the possibility of becoming a person. The human relationship of one, the person to the other person, person to neighbor, is constitutive of personhood. Now, we know very well it's constitutive of society, but we often do not see this more profound point, that a solitary person is no person and is extracted from the possibility of becoming a person. It takes two to tango. It takes two to be a person. God made another, so that the second constitutive element in personhood is the relational character of personhood. And now the third constitutive member is that God put them in the garden. Now the Hebrew word there for the garden does not point to the gardens at Trinity College, Cambridge, or the garden in our backyards where we raise chrysanthemums and carrots and so forth. The garden is really a Hebrew word which translated means the whole fertile and fecund nature. A nature which is capable of begetting its own after its kind. So God thrusts man, roots him in nature. And notice man's relationship to nature is such that in the third chapter of Genesis, I think the story there reads that God placed him in the garden with the directive to tend it. That means that the garden, the world of nature, is God's other creation who stands alongside his creation of persons and is not a neutral or stupid or mute dead nature, but a living creation which is constitutive of man. Man's conversation with nature, his life with nature, from which he comes, and which he is commanded to tend, is constitutive of his personhood. And when his relationship passes from a tending of nature to a rapacious assault upon nature, the deepest damage is not to nature, but the primary damage is to man himself. And here's an aspect of the whole environmental thing that I want to get to in a bit. So that the God relationship, the horizontal, which is the vertical one, to use images, the horizontal relationship with the person and the neighboring person, and man's relationship to God's other creation, nature, these constitute an integral, as one might call, a kind of primal trinity of constituent compositions, which make up what we mean by the human person. And then, of course, God breathed into him, in that wonderful metaphor, he breathed into him literally the breath of his own livingness. We have an old chorale in our church, Lord, the life of all the living. That's an exact translation. The livingness of God, who is the fountain of life, is the constitutive principle whereby man is nature plus. Now, this is the earliest of the biblical images in terms of our modern, the way the Bible is modernly published, though the book of Genesis, as a matter of fact, comes fairly late in the Old Testament writings. But it stands first by our fathers, apparently put it first because it deals with first things. Now, I would suggest another step. It's very significant that the Hebrew language has no general word for nature. That seems incredible to us. How could we get along in modern culture, technology, science, without a general word to point to the whole creation of the non-personal kind, the whole vast theater in which we tiny people crawl around? That is the world of nature. But the Hebrew tongue has no word. They have word, plenty of words for aspects of nature, animals, flowers, herbs, hills, snow, rain, water, flood, the whole works. But they have no general word. Why? They needed none. They never thought of nature as over against man. They never thought of man as being God's whole concern, as it were, that God exists just for man. He is the Father that fathers forth all things. And therefore, for nature, they simply meant everything that God has made. You get this brilliantly and lyrically articulated in the 104th Psalm, I suppose. There may be other places, but it's the one that speaks most movingly to me. You remember in the 104th Psalm, the various aspects of nature are given wonderfully concise little epigrammatic designations. These, the little animals, the great animals, the wine that maketh glad the heart of man, and oil that maketh his face to shine, and all the animals interrelated in an ecological situation whereby they depend upon the grain and the fruit and the fruits of the earth, and then they are interrelated in their lives with one another, including the predators who keep the balance of nature. And then the story builds up to the final coda, including man: all these depend upon thee. They all owe their life to thee. You send forth your livingness as spirit, and they are. You withdraw your spirit, they die and return to their dust. Now, this whole picture could be called a kind of theological ecology, that man subsists in a vast cosmic ecological structure, all of which, according to the Christian and Jewish faith, is from the creation of God. The man who asked me last night about the doctrine of the Holy Trinity will get from me no exposition of that. I did something better. I gave him a good article. But when we talk about God the Father, let us be sure we don't just think of that New Testamently. God the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, God the Father figure of some of the parables. But the Father in Hebrew means the generative fountain of all life. So that the word Father is older than and is presupposed in everything that Jesus said, whose scriptures were the Old Testament. Now, this understanding of nature, which has characterized the biblical story, is really not much further elaborated in the New Testament. The issues there did not require it. Jesus, in his preaching, apparently could presuppose this understanding of God and man and the neighbor and nature, and he does indeed presuppose it with what artless simplicity, with what naturalness Jesus talks about regard the lilies of the field. And the other natural references he makes, nature is never, in the language of Jesus, something that's a kind of resource out of which we are to dig iron and copper and zinc and pump oil. It is the theater of man's life, the delightful, created, fecund theater, the garden of his life, which it is his obligation to tend. Some years ago, about 5 years ago, you remember we had an Earth Day here in these United States, in which the environmental crisis was, there was an effort to dramatize it, and the school children, the college people, all of us were encouraged to attend to these things. And then a leading article in that little paperback was one by Professor Lynn White of the University of California, called The Theological Roots of Our Environmental Crisis. And Lynn White, in that essay, which has been widely reprinted, makes a very serious charge. It's so serious that I want to recapitulate his argument for you. He says, if we trace back what happened in Western culture, in the development of Western Christian culture, that has permitted the Christian community unprotestingly to participate in modern man's assault upon the natural world. How did they lose? What annihilated the profound biblical teaching of man's responsibility for nature? Where did it disappear? What happened? He says the fundamental reason for that lies in the theology of the Western Church. He said we got it straight from the Bible by a profound misunderstanding. The Bible was, for some centuries, communicated to the Western world principally in the Latin text. And the text of the first chapter of Genesis reads that God created man, placed him in the garden, and said, "You are to have dominion over." Well, the fish, the cattle, the sea, everything. You're to have dominion. Now that was translated into Latin, dominium terrae, and that is exactly what it says. It's a good translation. But what do we mean by the word dominion in English? We regularly read domination, so that every predatorial person in Western capitalist society who has engaged and organized others to, without regard to what happens to nature, to take from it what they wanted, many of them have appealed to the Bible. God said you were to have dominion, exercise domination over the world. Well, the Old Testament says no such thing. The verb used that's translated into Latin, dominium terrae, is a Hebrew word which means the world of the natural world is to be held down in its proper order. It is God's world, but it is not God. Nature is God's, but it is not God. Now that was important for the Hebrew teacher to say, because they were surrounded by people for whom the world of nature was divinized. The nature was the realm, the force, the power of the gods. So the Hebrews were told the nature is God's, but you are to keep it in its proper place. And that was translated, have dominion over, which I think in the nature of language led us to believe that it was a good biblical doctrine, as Andrew Carnegie, a good Presbyterian, used to preach, to get all you can, save all you can, squeeze as much as you can out of every aspect of the church, of the world's fruitfulness. And that was all on good Christian doctrinal basis. Well, that is a profound misunderstanding. And one can secure the truth of that by looking at the language in which the world of nature is talked of in the Old Testament. in which the notion of tending, caring for, is a very real aspect of the literary culture of the Semitic world. Interestingly, we have some other linguistic habits which are a bit misleading. We talk about mother nature. That would be good Persian talk or Canaanitish talk. It is not good Christian talk. God is our father. The church is our mother. That is, as Lutheran language, as Luther says, the church is the mother who bears forth the faithful because she transmits the message of the divine word. And nature is our sister, in a certain metaphor. She is God's other creation for whom we are to care, as it were, a little sister. Now, this kind of aspect or understanding of man in the biblical speech is, as I say, in my understanding of it, not much changed or complicated in the New Testament. It simply is presupposed there. But the New Testament does not talk a great deal about nature. And in the passages where, principally in Paul, where nature is talked about, the intentionality of the writer is sometimes obscure and not altogether consistent. Now, where do we go from here? I think we ought now to take a considerable jump, and try to account for how it happened that the West, in the whole development of Western culture, in which development the Christian tradition has been a powerful agent, how did it happen that this scientifically informed, technologically machined assault upon nature has become a perilous fact of our modern time? I think it came about largely as an extension of the Renaissance, followed by what the French call l'illumination, the Germans the Aufklärung, and we simply call the awakening, the time to which we ascribe the beginnings of natural science, physical science, chemistry, physics, medicine, pharmacology, in the 16th, the great 17th century, and with increasing momentum up into our own time, the natural sciences, experimentally, speculatively, technologically, have developed with such an awesome speed that they are virtually the makers of the modern world. Some of us thought of this when the blackout occurred in New York. Think of how an entire city is built on electric power. They can build buildings from 80 to 100 stories high because they have elevators. Without elevators, it would be stupid, impossible. Everything runs. I sat down the other night and figured how many motors we have in a 7-room apartment. 26. You sit down someday in your kitchen and start looking all the way around, from the electric razor, and there might be an electric toothbrush, an electric can opener, a blender, a washer, a dryer, a dishwasher, a refrigerator. You go right through the house to the window ventilators, air conditioners. You'll end up with at least 20 motors, I'm sure, if you're a normal American family, a patriotic American consuming more and more. In a sense, the Renaissance was a startling opening of man to the wonders of the natural world in virtue of new knowledge of method whereby to study nature. Almost a motto for the Renaissance would be Francis Bacon's word, "Let us now lay aside the feckless disputations of the theologians and philosophers, and let us behold, look steadfastly at things." If you want to understand why children, 30 or 40% of the children born in a Viennese hospital in the mid-19th century died of what they called childbed fever. If you want to understand why children, 30 or 40% of the children born in a Viennese hospital in the mid-19th century died of what they called childbed fever, it wasn't until a man named Samuel Semmelweis saw a connection between examinations in the maternity ward by students who never washed their hands, who came straight from the dissecting room. He saw a relationship between that and the high mortality rate. He knew nothing about microbes or about bacteria, but there was a connection. And when he made them wash their hands in carbolic solutions, the death rate plummeted, and the whole medical faculty fired him. I remember some years ago when I first went to Vienna. There in the middle of the old square at the university is a cast figure of Samuel Semmelweis, and under it a most memorable statement. It says, "To the memory of Samuel Semmelweis, who to the disgrace of this university was dismissed from his post in the year so-and-so." Semmelweis, Pasteur, Lister, Koch in medicine, Freud in psychology, Weber, Trelsch in sociology, Einstein, Max Planck, Fermi, Compton, Millikan in physics. The names could be piled up in every discipline in which man, peering steadfastly at things, asking not after the angelic constitution of aluminum, but after the atomic construction of it, began to unfold a world of unimaginable complexity and wonderful interconnectedness. Now, this is the world which is constitutive maybe of not our minds. At my age, I could know none of this and I wouldn't change very much. But my children grow up in that world. I've had to learn it. They get it from the first geography book, or the first physics or chemistry book they get in school. Now I'm back to the original question. Have we a theology for a world ecologically structured? You see, we should never talk about the ecological crisis. Ecology is not a crisis. Ecology is a fact. We can talk about the environmental crisis because that's what we do or fail to do within an ecologically structured universe. But ecology is not in crisis. The relationship between the stream out here and the tailings on the mountainside and the snow and the storms and the tree fall and the leaf fall and the animal life and the garbage and sewage created by human habitation. These are all together in what the Old Testament calls the web of creation. A beautiful phrase. Reminds one of weaving. The web of creation. Now, if that be the way things are, what Christian understanding might have the possibility to pull all this understanding of the creation together into a theology of care, of delight. I think it was that kind of question bugging my mind that is at the bottom of what has constituted my theological concentration for 20 years. I kept asking that question, and the answers I got were 25-cent answers to a $64 question. My church, as long as 15 years ago, was churning out little pamphlets about stewardship. And now they started going from money to some side remarks about we also ought to take care of the world and the earth as a part of man's stewardship, but it was definitely a footnote, a kind of afterthought. You can't solve the whole problem by stewardship, though that's a perfectly good word and a very powerful idea, that man has a steward's relationship to God's creation. But I don't think that's a big enough doctrine, because it isn't central enough. And it's by pulling that question back, that I began to suspect that nothing less than the doctrine of grace would be an adequate doctrine to shape the Christian community's mind and practice in a way appropriate to the catastrophe in the environment. Now let me try to elaborate that a little bit. When I utter the word grace, what is the first thing that comes to your mind? The grace of God, which is most concrete and dramatically given me in the forgiveness of sins, in the making right, in the justification of sinners, in making right my relation to Him. Now that is certainly true. It is central, but it is not comprehensive enough. I want to suggest to you that here we have a Lutheran theological position, which I think is certainly not wrong, but is inadequate. Now, of course, there was a time when even for a Lutheran to say that anything in Lutheran theology was inadequate was a very perilous operation. But at the age of 73 since yesterday, and holding tenure only in the Social Security system, I can say that now if I like. I think our doctrine of grace is true but inadequate, because it confines the reality of grace to the second person of the Trinity, the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ. Is there no grace in the creation? Now, if we mean by grace what, and the word is not a New Testament invention, or chesed in the Old Testament, or can only be translated grace. God is gracious. The word is on David's lips many times. The important thing about the New Testament is the phrase in the fourth gospel, that grace came by Jesus Christ. It doesn't say it was invented by Him. It's the coming, the concretization of the grace of God in Jesus. It is the appearing, the manifestation. These are all words used by the early witnesses. The concretization, the manifestation, the epiphany, the disclosure, the representation, the incarnation of grace is God becoming God in a fresh way in the one born of Mary. So the grace of God is not simply a property of the second person of the Trinity or the second article of the Creed. God creates His creation in grace. The creation itself is a realm of grace. Now, it is not a realm of grace which is an adequate disclosure of grace, but it is a disclosure. The beauty, the order, the wonder, the allure of the creation is an invitation to the mind to suppose that something is going on here. Something, or better, someone is back of all this. Let me get at it from another way. A typical and important Old Testament word is the Chavod Yahweh, the glory of God. Now the word the glory is for us a kind of hallelujah word, pointing to a kind of imagined incandescence around the Holy One. And that's all right, that's true too. Isaiah in the temple, holy, 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 and then the word comes, the seraphim and the cherubim are creatures, metaphors for the appearance of the kavod, the glory. But the glory in the Old Testament language means the light the holy gives off, the illumination of things by the presence within them of the power and the goodness and the will of God. There you behold the glory. You read the Psalms, watching for the way that word is used. Too bad that we have used the word glorious in such a loose way that the old root of it, which is transcendent, that root has now become so common that it's almost ruined. You say, I had a glorious banana split, you know. Now that's hardly a transcendental reference. Although to teenagers it comes very close. But the word yikavod, the glory, points to that in the creation which is transparent to the Creator. The heavens declare the glory of God. That is, they elicit from the beholding mind or feeling a sense of wonder and awe, and more than that, a sense of astounded gratitude, as Tillich used to say, astonishment because there is something rather than nothing. Now this is all a function of the glory. We must be very careful to read the text carefully. The heavens disclose the glory of God, but we must not go on to say that the heavens disclose the will of God, so that by going out on Sunday morning and looking up at the heavens from the seventh tee, you have performed an adequate act of obedience. The will of God is not disclosed via the heavens, but the glory of God, according to the scriptures, is. Now, last night, when I tried to push my question Christologically, I got a hold of a strand in New Testament witness which has been almost suppressed. I don't mean violently suppressed, but rather downgraded, ignored, given a low level of attention by most Protestant theologians. That is, that kind of ascription to Christ, which talks of him as being the principle of the created world, the interior life of the created world, that toward which the created world moves, or in the wonderful phrase from the Ephesians, the universe formed in, for, and through Christ. This is a remarkable statement. How shall we prove such a statement? If we have a kind of Christology, first a theology, and then even a Christology for the created world, for the ecological structure of things, how could we establish any truth claim for such a statement? Let me say, I don't think we could establish a truth claim for the statement. But the statement can get a force, a suasive force, by going at it another way. If I deal with things as if they were, because they are created of God, His, if I deal with the whole world as if it were the residency of a kind of grace, then the world thus dealt with by a kind of empiricism of outcomes, that is, by a way in which it deals with me, continues to be. If I deal with the world as my Father's world, it will remain a world for human habitation and for growth and development. If I deal with the world as if it were simply an endless mine, an endless oil well, an infinite ocean into which I can dump whatever I wish, then the world will take its reprisals. Because in a sense, to deal with the world non-religiously, if I may say so, non-spiritually, is an impractical way to deal with the world. I remember a year ago, the United States Steel Corporation was under such heavy pressure from the Department of Justice to clean up the steel mills in and around Chicago that they, for the first time, began to take seriously the fact that these guys really mean business. They're going to have our hide if we don't do it. They had been warned many times and did virtually nothing. Now at last they're at it. But during those days, a man I knew in other connections asked if I would meet at their executive luncheon and talk about these matters. And I said, yes, but you know, I'm no steel maker, I'm no businessman or banker, I'll have to do my own thing. Well, he said, that's why I asked. And so I went, and I had a strange feeling that these men began to see that a reverential dealing with the world is, in the long haul, the only practical way to deal with the world, because it secures the continuation, the reenactment of the drama of creation, fecundation, reproduction. That can go on. But if we deal with the world with instant practicality, get the most at the lowest price, the quickest you can, and the hell with the consequences. That very practical attitude is ultimately a fatal assault upon the world. Now, I've got to knock off here very soon, but one more point. How do we deal with this in our congregation? Well, I think I've already given you free enough text to last you for 6 months, but another practical point. I want to talk about two conferences I went to several years ago. At Massachusetts Institute of Technology, there was a conference in which representatives of all the natural physical scientists were called together for a whole week under the title, The Obligation of the Scientific Community in the Environmental Crisis. And through a kind of a fluke, I got invited too. And I listened for a whole week to extraordinarily competent analyses from chemists, physicists, marine biologists, all kinds of people, as to the actual structures with which they were dealing and what the problems were. At the end of that conference, they issued a statement, and the statement was almost verbatim as follows. There is much that the scientific community can do, and more that we propose to do about the environmental crisis. But no conceivable refinement of scientific procedures will be adequate to deal with the increasing pollution of the natural world unless our people are changed in the spirit of their minds. I don't think they knew they were quoting St. Paul. Changed in the spirit of their minds. Now notice, they didn't say just change their minds. They wanted to get something deeper. I must not only change the way I think about procedures, the spirit in which I think must be changed. Now that's a hard distinction to make, but I think I can illustrate it. And I can illustrate it with a rather awesome event that's happened in the new translations of the New Testament. I saw a brand new translation not long ago that is trying to get as idiomatic as humanly possible. And in the process of being idiomatic, it's virtually it's virtually crushed out every dimension of meaning in the biblical language. It has dumbified the language down to the point that it's almost obvious. You remember the beautiful phrase, regard the lilies of the field, they toil not, neither do they spin. Now, to be sure, there's an antique word there, regard the lilies, is an old word, but it's perfectly clear. They toil not, we don't talk much about toil, we go to work. They're old words, but they're still clear. This translation had, look at those lilies. Now that is a different statement. That is fundamental. The first words, regard the lilies of the field, the language lies tenderly upon the thing referred to. The language is inherent with love, affection, tenderness. That's the spirit of the mind, not just the work of the mind. And the work of the mind can make up all kinds of sense. But the spirit of the mind has a feeling for what language is appropriate to this or that situation. And therefore the MIT bigwig said, we can do much, we will do more, but don't labor under the illusion that the scientific community, as most of our people really believe, well, they got us into this mess, they'll find a way to clean it up. The guys who do the cleaning up say, no way, no way, unless you change in the spirit of your mind, the way we deal with nature, we cannot keep up. The second conference was at my university, and it was a legal conference, lawyers and legislators. What is the obligation of the civic, the legislative and legal community? They came out with virtually the same thing. They said there's much that can be done by statutory and legal procedures, but let us not be under the illusion that the pace of legislation, which is a crawl, can ever catch up with the pace of pollution, which is a gallop. And therefore, do not depend upon the legislature or the Congress or public law to do what must be done in your kitchen, in your plant, in your daily life. Now, that being the case, is it not the more interesting that the church has been virtually silent? We have had some moralistic little essays in the Lutheran Standard and the Lutheran and here and there about taking back the papers and smashing the cans, and we should do both. But there has been no primary theological reflection on this point to ask, is it, in a sense, a Christian disobedience, a Christian churlishness before the grace of God that we deal with his creation this way? Well, that is the theological position to which I, now 2 hours ago, began marching, and I think at that point I will stop. Well, yes, I'll stop whether I want to or not. And tomorrow night, I want to move into a related but quite different subject, but I'll wait till tomorrow night to tell you about it.
Glad we aren't having you at Fireside again this evening. I'm sure there could be questions. Why don't we take 3 or 4 minutes in case someone might want to simply respond right away. Yes?
Could you and would you suggest some alternatives in the sense of taking care of pollution to go back to the good old days, to be back to the manure piles and all those flies and the horses on the street and all that kind of stuff? It wasn't such a clean age, you know, in the good old days either. So what are the alternatives for the future in cleaning up pollution?
I'm not sure, but I know that isn't the one. One does not move backward. One does not ever historically return to a former procedure, not on a large scale. The world's population could not be maintained by the old ways, nor could we run our life the old ways. We must find ways to, some procedures have got to be dropped, some strictly, more strictly regulated. new kinds of energy sources must be found, and there's an awful lot of mythology about atomic power. I think the best thing I can do is, in these few minutes, is to give you a little bibliography. That'll resound with more competence than I have long after I've departed. There are several little books you all ought, every minister, I think, particularly as he prepares data and images and metaphors for preaching, he ought to know these. Anything of Loren Eisley, E-I-S-E-L-E-Y, L. Eisley, The Immense Journey, The Firmament of Time, The Unexpected Universe, these are three paperbacks. A book by Barry Commoner called The Closing Circle, C-O-M-M-O-N-E-R, The Closing Circle, paperback. The Earth book in a paperback edited by, well, I don't know, but any college bookstore would have it, that has the Lynn White article in it. A book by René Dubos, D-U-B-O-S. René Dubos, The God Within. Some of the theology is suspect, but the ecology is superbly done. Well, that's enough for the moment. But the notion that one can roll back historical development and technological developments, that is simply not true. We can roll back the kind of engines we make, and we can roll back the kind of power we think we need for going to the corner drugstore and get a tube of toothpaste. You really don't need 235 horsepower, eight cylinders. Many, many practical instant changes we could make. But I would remind you that when the president suggested a very modest way to make a beginning, his program is being killed by a death of 1,000 qualifications. By the time the Congress gets through qualifying it, every state making its own qualification, the lumber interests wanting nothing done that will touch them, the oil interests want to remain untouched, the gas interests, the transportation interests, by the time we get through chipping away at the program, we will have a kind of a wreckage of a grand idea. But it will not die, therefore. It will have to be done, if not now, then next year.
I think we should break now, and 9 o'clock promptly will be our vespers here.